Symposium, a dialogue of Apollodorus with companion.
I think I'm actually well prepared to answer what you're asking. Just the other day I happened to be walking up to the city from my house in Phalarum, when someone I know spotted me from behind, some way off, and called out joking as he called, "Hey, you there, the man from Phalarum, Apollodorus, won't you wait up?" So I stopped and waited. And he said, "Apollodorus, I was actually just looking for you, because I wanted to ask you about the party at Agathon's, the one with Socrates and Alcibiades and the others who were there at that dinner, what exactly was said about love. Someone else told me about it, from what he'd heard from Phoenix son of Philip, and he said you knew about it too, but he couldn't give me anything clear. So you tell me you're the right person, since you're used to reporting your companion's words. But first," he said, "tell me, were you actually there yourself, at this gathering or not?" And I said, "It certainly sounds like whoever told you gave you nothing clear at all, if you think this gathering you're asking about happened recently, so that I could have been there." "That's what I thought," he said. "How could you think that, Glaucon?" I said. "Don't you know that Agathon hasn't lived here for years, and that it's not even 3 years yet since I've been spending my time with Socrates and making it my business to know whatever he says or does each day? Before that I used to run around wherever I happened to go, thinking I was doing something, when really I was more pathetic than anyone, no less than you are right now, thinking one should do anything at all rather than practice philosophy." And he said, "Don't mock me, just tell me when this gathering took place." And I said it was when we were still boys, when Agathon won with his first tragedy, the day after he and his chorus offered the victory sacrifice. "That was a long time ago then, it seems," he said. "But who told you about it? Not Socrates himself?" "No, by Zeus," I said, "the same man who told Phoenix, a man named Aristodemus from Cydathenium, a small fellow always without sandals. He was there at the gathering, being, I think, about the most devoted of Socrates' admirers at that time. Though I did later ask Socrates some things about what I'd heard from Aristodemus, and he confirmed it just as Aristodemus had told it." "Well then," he said, "why don't you tell it to me? The road to the city is certainly good for talking and listening as we walk." So as we went along, we talked it over between us, which is why, as I said at the start, I'm not unprepared. So if I need to tell it to you all as well, that's what I should do. And really, whenever I'm having some conversation about philosophy myself, or listening to others, quite apart from thinking it does me good, I get an extraordinary pleasure from it. But whenever I hear some other kind of talk, especially the kind you rich businessmen go in for, I get annoyed myself and feel sorry for you, my friends, because you think you're accomplishing something when you're accomplishing nothing. And perhaps you in turn think I'm the wretched one, and I suspect you're right to think so. But as for you, I don't just think it, I know it for a fact.
You're always the same, Apollodorus, always running yourself down along with everyone else. You seem to me to think absolutely everyone is miserable except Socrates, starting with yourself. And I have no idea where you got this nickname of yours, the softy, because in your talk, at least, you're always harsh, both toward yourself and toward everyone else except Socrates.
My dear fellow, isn't it obvious that thinking this way about myself and about all of you means I'm out of my mind, quite mad?
This isn't worth arguing about right now, Apollodorus. Just do what we asked, don't put us off, tell us what was said.
Well then, it went something like this. Or rather, let me try to tell it to you from the beginning, the way Aristodemus told it to me. He said Socrates ran into him freshly bathed and wearing sandals, which he rarely did, and Aristodemus asked him where he was going, looking so handsome. And Socrates said he was going to dinner at Agathon's. Yesterday I dodged him at the victory celebration, afraid of the crowd, but I promised to come today. So I've dressed up like this, to go looking handsome to a handsome man's house. But you, he said, how do you feel about coming along to dinner uninvited? And Aristodemus said he answered, whatever you say. Come along then, Socrates said, and let's ruin the old saying, giving it a twist, that good men go uninvited to the feasts of good men. Homer, after all, doesn't just ruin that saying, but practically assaults it. He makes Agamemnon an outstandingly good man in war, and Menelaus a weak spearman, And yet when Agamemnon is holding a sacrifice and feast, he has Menelaus come to the banquet, uninvited, the lesser man, to the better man's table. Hearing this, Aristodemus said, I suppose I run the same risk myself then, Socrates, not as you put it, but rather as Homer would have it, going as an ordinary man, uninvited, to the feast of a wise one. So think about what defense you'll give for bringing me, since I won't admit to coming uninvited. I'll say you invited me. Two going together, Socrates said, can plan on the way what we'll say. Let's go. So talking along these lines, Aristodemus said, they went on. But Socrates, paying attention to something in his own thoughts along the way, fell behind, and when Aristodemus waited for him, he told him to go on ahead. When they got to Agathon's house, they found the door open, and something funny happened to Aristodemus there. One of the house slaves met him right away and led him to where the others were already reclining, and he found them just about to start dinner. As soon as Agathon saw him, he said, Aristodemus, you've come at just the right time to join us for dinner. If you came for some other reason, put it off for another time. I was looking for you yesterday to invite you and couldn't find you anywhere. But how is it you haven't brought Socrates to us? And I said, Aristodemus, turned around and saw Socrates wasn't following anywhere behind me. So I said that I had come with Socrates myself, having been invited by him to this dinner. You did well to come, he said, but where is he? He was just coming in behind me. I'm actually wondering myself where he could be. Won't you go look, boy, said Agathon, and bring Socrates in. And you, Aristodemus, take the couch next to Eryximachus. A slave washed his feet so he could recline, and then another of the slaves came in to report that Socrates had withdrawn and was standing in the neighbor's doorway, and wouldn't come in no matter how they called him. That's strange, Agathon said. Go call him again, and don't let him alone. But Aristodemus said, no, leave him be, it's a habit of his. Sometimes he steps aside, wherever he happens to be, and just stands there. He'll come soon enough, I think. Don't disturb him, just let him be. Well, if you think so, that's what we should do, Agathon said. But the rest of us, slaves, let's have our meal. Just serve whatever you like, since there's no one supervising you now, which I've never done before, so now, treating me and these guests here as if we'd all been invited by you, look after us well, so we'll have reason to praise you. After this, he said, they had dinner, but Socrates still hadn't come in. Agathon kept telling them to go fetch him, but Aristodemus wouldn't allow it. Eventually Socrates did come in, not having taken as long as usual, but just about when they were halfway through dinner. Agathon, who happened to be reclining alone at the far end, said, come here, Socrates, lie down next to me, so that by touching you I might get some benefit from that wise thought that came to you in the doorway. Clearly you found it, and have it now, otherwise you wouldn't have come away. And Socrates sat down and said, it would be a fine thing, Agathon, if wisdom were the sort of thing that flowed from the fuller of us into the emptier just by our touching each other, the way water flows through a woolen thread from the fuller cup into the emptier one. If wisdom really worked that way, then I'd value very highly this place next to you, since I think I'd be filled up from you with a great deal of fine wisdom. My own wisdom might be a poor thing, or even doubtful, like a dream, but yours is brilliant and has a great capacity for growth, seeing how it blazed out from you so strongly while you're still young, and became visible just the other day before more than 30,000 witnesses of the Greeks. You're being insolent, Socrates, said Agathon. We'll settle this question of wisdom between us a little later, with Dionysus as our judge. For now, turn your attention to dinner first. After this, he said, when Socrates had reclined and eaten along with the others, they poured libations, sang a hymn to the god, and did the other customary things, and then turned to drinking. Pausanias, he said, opened up a discussion something like this. Well, gentlemen, he said, how can we make our drinking as easy as possible? For my part, I'll tell you that I'm really in a bad way from yesterday's drinking, and I need some recovery time, and I think many of you are in the same state, since you were there yesterday too. So let's think about how we might drink as comfortably as possible. Aristophanes said, that's well said, Pausanias, that we should arrange things somehow to make the drinking easier. I myself am one of those who got thoroughly soaked yesterday. Hearing them, Eryximachus, son of Acumenes, said, you're both quite right. But there's one more of you I'd like to hear from, how you feel about your strength for drinking, Agathon. Not at all up to it, he said, I'm not strong either. It would be a godsend for us, it seems, Eryximachus said, for me and Aristodemus and Phaedrus and these others, if you who are the strongest drinkers are worn out now, we're always weak drinkers ourselves. Socrates, I leave out of the discussion, he's up to either, so whichever we do will suit him fine. So since it seems to me none of those present is eager for a lot of wine drinking, perhaps I'll be less unwelcome if I tell you the plain truth about what drunkenness is like. This much, I think, has become quite clear to me from medicine, that drunkenness is a hard thing for people. I myself wouldn't willingly want to drink to excess, nor would I advise anyone else to, especially someone still suffering from yesterday's hangover. Well, said Phaedrus of Myrhinus, breaking in, I'm used to obeying you, especially on matters of medicine, and so I think will the rest, if they're sensible. Hearing this, they all agreed not to make this present gathering one of heavy drinking, but to drink just for pleasure, as they pleased. Since this much is decided then, Eryximachus said, that each should drink as much as he wants, with no compulsion, I propose next that we send away the flute girl who just came in, let her play for herself, or for the women inside if she likes, and that we spend today in conversation with each other instead. And if you're willing, I'd like to suggest what kind of conversation. Everyone, he said, agreed and wanted him to introduce it. So Eryximachus said, my opening then follows Euripides' Melanip, for the story I'm about to tell isn't mine, it's Phaedrus's here. Phaedrus is always complaining to me. Isn't it strange, Eryximachus, he says, that for other gods the poets have composed hymns and paeans, but for love, who is such a great and important god, not one of all the poets who have ever lived has composed a single encomium. And if you want to consider the accomplished sophists as well, they write prose eulogies of Heracles and others, as the excellent Prodicus does. That's not so surprising, but I've actually come across a book by a clever man in which salt received a marvelous eulogy for its usefulness, and you could find plenty of other such things praised. Yet though people have taken such trouble over things like that, no human being to this day has ever dared to him love properly. So great a god has been utterly neglected. This seems right to me, what Phaedrus says. So I want to make a contribution to him and do him this favor, and at the same time it strikes me as fitting, given the occasion, for those of us here to honor the god. So if you all agree too, we could pass the time well enough in speeches. I think each of us in turn, going around to the right, should speak in praise of love, as fine a speech as he can manage, and Phaedrus should begin, since he's reclining first and is, besides, the father of the idea. No one will vote against you on this, Eryximachus, said Socrates. I certainly won't refuse, since I claim to understand nothing but matters of love, nor will Agathon, I imagine, or Pausanias, nor Aristophanes either, whose whole business is Dionysus and Aphrodite, nor anyone else here that I can see. Though it isn't quite fair to those of us reclining last, but if the ones before us speak well and fully enough, that will satisfy us. Well then, good luck to him. Let Phaedrus begin and sing the praises of love. All the others agreed with this and urged the same as Socrates. Now Aristodemus didn't remember everything each speaker said, word for word, and I don't remember everything he told me either. But I'll tell you the parts of each speech that stood out most and seemed to me worth recalling. First then, as I said, Phaedrus began somewhere around here, that love is a great god, marvelous among both men and gods in many ways, but not least in his origin. For it is a mark of honor to be among the oldest of the gods, he said, and here is the proof. Love has no parents, and none are mentioned by anyone, whether ordinary person or poet, but Hesiod says that first chaos came to be, and then broad-breasted earth, the ever-secure seat of all things, and love. Acusilaus agrees with Hesiod that these two came into being after chaos, earth, and love. And Parmenides says of her origin, first of all the gods she devised love. So from many sources, it is agreed that love is among the oldest of the gods. And being the oldest, he is the cause of the greatest goods for us. For I myself can't say what greater good there is for a young man right from the start than a worthy lover, and for a lover, a worthy boy to love. For what ought to guide people all their lives, if they mean to live well, cannot be instilled so effectively by family ties, or public honors, or wealth, or anything else, as by love. And what do I mean by this? I mean shame at what is disgraceful, and ambition for what is honorable. Without these, neither a city nor a private person can achieve anything great or fine. So I say that if a man in love were caught doing something shameful, or suffering it from someone else without defending himself out of cowardice, he would be more pained to be seen that way by his beloved than by his father or his friends or anyone else in the world. And we see the same thing in the one who is loved. He is especially ashamed before his lovers when he's caught doing something disgraceful. So if there were some way to bring about a city or an army made up of lovers and their beloveds, there could be no better way for them to govern their own affairs than by keeping away from everything disgraceful and competing with one another for honor. And men like that, fighting alongside each other, few as they might be, would practically conquer the whole world. For a man in love would surely rather be seen by anyone else than by his beloved deserting his post or throwing away his weapons. He'd choose to die many times over before that. And as for abandoning one's beloved, or failing to help him in danger, no one is so cowardly that love himself couldn't inspire him with courage, making him equal to the man who is bravest by nature. And quite literally, what Homer said, that a god breathed might into some of the heroes, this is exactly what love provides to those who love, coming from himself. And what's more, only lovers are willing to die for one another, not just men, but women too. Alcestis, the daughter of Peleus, gives ample proof of this claim before the Greeks, since she alone was willing to die for her husband, though he had both a father and a mother living. But she so far surpassed them in devotion, because of her love, that she showed them up as strangers to their son, related to him in name only. And when she did this deed, it seemed so noble not only to men, but to the gods as well that, of the many people who have done many noble things, the gods granted this privilege to only a few to bring their soul back up again from Hades, but hers they sent back up, in admiration of her deed. So even the gods honor above all this devotion and excellence concerning love. But Orpheus, son of Oegrus, they sent away from Hades unsatisfied, showing him only a phantom of the wife he had come for, without giving her to him, because he seemed soft, being a lyre player, after all, and not brave enough to die for love as Alcestis had, but instead contrived to go down into Hades alive. That's exactly why they punished him, and made it so that he died at the hands of women, rather than honoring him as they honored Achilles, son of Thetis, whom they sent to the Isles of the Blessed, because though he had learned from his mother that he would die if he killed Hector, and would live to old age and go home if he did not, he dared to choose to help his lover Patroclus, and after avenging him, to die not merely for him, but after him, since he was already dead. For this, the gods were full of admiration, and honored him even more highly, because he valued his lover so greatly. Aeschylus talks nonsense when he claims Achilles was in love with Patroclus, Achilles, who was more beautiful not only than Patroclus, but than all the other heroes as well, and still beardless, and moreover much younger, as Homer says. But in truth, while the gods honor this excellence connected with love most of all, they admire and reward it even more, and treat it even better, when the beloved loves his lover than when the lover loves his boy. For the lover is more divine than the beloved, since he is inspired by the god. That is why the gods honored Achilles even above Alcestis, sending him off to the Isles of the Blessed. So I say that love is among the gods the oldest, the most honored, and the most authoritative for human beings to acquire virtue and happiness, both while they live and after they die. This, more or less, was the speech Phaedrus gave, he said, and after Phaedrus, there were some other speeches which he didn't remember very well. Leaving those aside, he went on to describe Pausanias's speech. He said, "Phaedrus, I don't think our topic has been well set out for us, simply being told, just like that, to praise love. If love were one thing, this would be fine, but as it is, he isn't one thing, and since he isn't one, it's more correct to specify first which kind of love ought to be praised. So I'll try to correct this. First, I'll say which love should be praised, and then praise him in a way worthy of the god. We all know that there's no Aphrodite without love. If there were only one Aphrodite, there would be only one love. But since there are actually two Aphrodites, there must also be two loves. And surely there are two goddesses, one older, motherless, daughter of Uranus, whom we call heavenly Aphrodite, the other younger, daughter of Zeus and Dione, whom we call common Aphrodite. It follows, then, that the love who works alongside the second should rightly be called common love, and the other, heavenly love. Now one ought to praise all the gods, but I must try to say what falls to each of these two. For every action is like this, done just by itself, it is neither noble nor shameful. Take what we're doing right now, for instance, drinking or singing or conversing, none of these is in itself a fine thing, but depending on how it is done, in the doing, it turns out one way or the other. Done well and rightly it becomes noble, done wrongly, shameful. And so it is with loving and with love. Not every love is noble or worthy of praise, but only the one that inspires us to love nobly. Now the love that belongs to common Aphrodite is common indeed, and does whatever chance brings, and this is the love that inferior people feel. Such people, first of all, love women no less than boys. Next, they love bodies rather than souls, and further, they love whoever happens to be least intelligent, looking only to the accomplishment of the act, and caring nothing for whether it is done nobly or not. That's why it turns out for them, as chance would have it, sometimes good, sometimes just the opposite. For this love comes from the goddess, who is much younger than the other, and who partakes in her origin of both female and male. But the love of heavenly Aphrodite, first of all, has no share in the female, only in the male. This is the love of boys, and further, she is older, having no part in outrage. That is why those inspired by this love turn toward the male, cherishing what is naturally stronger and has more sense. And one could recognize, even within the practice of loving boys, those who are moved purely by this love. They don't fall in love with mere children, but only once the boys begin to show some intelligence, which happens around the time their beards start to grow. For I think those who begin to love at this point are prepared to spend their whole lives together and share their lives in common, not to deceive a young man, catching him off guard while he's still foolish, laugh at him, and run off to someone else. There ought, in fact, to be a law against loving young boys, so that a great deal of effort wouldn't be wasted on something so uncertain, for it's unclear how a boy will turn out, in either vice or virtue of soul and body. Good men set this rule for themselves willingly, but these common lovers ought to be compelled to observe something similar, just as we do our best to keep them from pursuing freeborn women. These are the men who have brought about the disgrace, so that some people dare to say it's shameful to grant favors to lovers. They say this looking at people like these, seeing their bad timing and injustice, since surely nothing done in an orderly and lawful way could justly incur blame. Now the custom concerning love in other cities is easy to understand, since it's simply defined, but here and in Sparta, it's complicated. In Elis and among the Boeotians, and wherever people aren't skilled speakers, it's simply established by law that granting favors to lovers is a fine thing, and no one, young or old, would say it's shameful. I think so that they won't have the trouble of trying to persuade the young with argument, since they're no good at speaking. But in Ionia and many other places under barbarian rule, it's considered shameful. For the barbarians, because of their tyrannies, consider this shameful, along with love of philosophy and love of physical training, for I don't think it serves the interests of rulers to have great ambitions grow up in their subjects, nor strong friendships and partnerships, which above all else love tends to produce. The tyrants here learned this by experience too, the love of Aristogiton and the friendship of Harmodius, once it became steadfast, brought down their rule. So wherever it's been laid down that granting favors to lovers is shameful, this rests on the badness of those who made the law, the greed of the rulers, and the cowardice of the ruled. And wherever it's been considered simply a fine thing, that's due to the laziness of soul in those who made the law. Here the law has been laid down in a far better way than in those places, though, as I said, it isn't easy to understand. If you think about it, it's said to be finer to love openly than in secret, and especially to love the noblest and best, even if they're less handsome than others. And also that everyone gives the lover remarkable encouragement, as if he were doing nothing shameful, and that winning his beloved seems admirable, while failing seems disgraceful. And the law has given the lover license, when he's attempting to win his beloved, to do astonishing things and still be praised for them, things which, if anyone dared to do them pursuing any other goal whatsoever, he would earn the harshest reproaches from philosophy itself. For if someone wanting to get money from another, or to hold office, or gain some other kind of power, were willing to do the sort of things lovers do toward their beloveds, making supplications and pleading entreaties in their requests, swearing oaths, sleeping on doorsteps, and being willing to perform a slavery that not even a slave would perform, he would be stopped from acting this way by both friends and enemies, the former reproaching him for flattery and servility, the latter admonishing him and feeling ashamed on his behalf. But when a lover does all these same things, there's grace attached to it, and the law grants him license to act this way without reproach, as though he were accomplishing something altogether admirable. And what's strangest of all, so most people say, is that he alone gets forgiveness from the gods for breaking his oaths, for they say there's no such thing as an oath sworn in the name of Aphrodite. Thus both gods and men have granted every license to the lover, as the law here declares. On this basis, then, one might suppose that in this city, both loving and being friends with lovers is considered a completely admirable thing. But then, when fathers set tutors over their beloved sons and don't let them converse with their lovers, and the tutor has strict instructions to that effect, and companions their own age reproach them if they see anything like that going on, and the older men don't stop those doing the reproaching or scold them for speaking wrongly, anyone looking at this, in turn, would suppose the opposite, that such behavior is considered utterly shameful here. The truth, I think, is this: the matter isn't simple. As was said at the start, it's neither fine in itself nor shameful in itself, but done in a fine way it's fine, done in a shameful way it's shameful. It's shameful to grant favors to a bad man in a bad way. It's fine to grant them to a good man in a good way. That common lover is bad, the one who loves the body rather than the soul, for he isn't even constant, since what he loves isn't constant either. The moment the bloom of the body he loved begins to fade, he's off and gone, having shamed many fine words and promises. But the one who loves a good character stays devoted for life, since he has attached himself to something constant. Our law wants to test these lovers thoroughly and well, and to make some worthy of favor while letting others escape it. That's why it urges some to pursue and others to flee, acting as judge and tester to see which sort the lover belongs to, and which sort the beloved. That's the reason, then, why being caught quickly is considered shameful, so that time may intervene, since time seems to be what tests most things well, and also why being caught through money or political power is shameful, whether because the boy, suffering badly, cringes and doesn't hold firm, or because, being benefited with money or political advancement, he doesn't look down on it. None of these things seems either secure or lasting, quite apart from the fact that no noble friendship has ever grown from them. So there's only one path left by our law, if a beloved is to grant favors to a lover in a fine way. Just as it was the rule for lovers that performing any slavery whatsoever willingly for their beloveds was not flattery and not to be reproached, so too, there's one other kind of willing slavery left that isn't reproachable, the slavery devoted to excellence. It's our custom that if someone is willing to serve another in the belief that through him he'll become better in some kind of wisdom or in some other part of excellence, this willing slavery is not considered shameful, nor is it flattery. These two customs, then, the one concerning the love of boys and the one concerning philosophy and excellence generally, must come together as one, if it's to turn out to be a fine thing for a beloved to grant favors to a lover. For when a lover and his beloved come together, each holding to his own rule, the one, that he's justified in performing any service whatsoever for a beloved who grants him favors. The other, that he's justified in rendering any service whatsoever to the one who makes him wise and good, the one able to contribute to wisdom and excellence generally, the other in need of acquiring education and wisdom generally. Then, when these two customs come together in the same place, it's only here and nowhere else that it turns out to be a fine thing for a beloved to grant favors to a lover. And in this case, being deceived brings no shame at all. In every other case, whether deceived or not, it brings shame. If someone grants favors to a lover as if to a rich man, for the sake of wealth, and is deceived and gets no money, because the lover turns out to be poor, it's just as shameful, for such a person seems to have shown what he really is, namely that for the sake of money, he'd serve anyone in any way, and that's not a fine thing. By the same reasoning, even if someone grants favors to a lover thinking him a good man, expecting to become better himself through this friendship, and is deceived because the man turns out bad, lacking excellence after all, even so the deception is a fine one. For this person too seems to have shown what he really is, namely that for the sake of excellence and becoming better he would go to any lengths for anyone, and that in turn is the finest thing of all. So it's altogether, and in every way, a fine thing to grant favors for the sake of excellence. This is the love that belongs to the heavenly goddess, itself heavenly, and worth a great deal both to the city and to individuals, since it compels both the lover himself and the beloved to take great care over their own excellence. All the other kinds of love belong to the other goddess, the common one. That, Phaedrus, is my contribution on the subject of love, offered on the spot as best I could. When Pausanias came to a stop, you see, the clever people have taught me to make these little balanced turns of phrase. Aristodemus said it was Aristophanes' turn to speak, but he happened to have a fit of hiccups from overreading or something else and couldn't speak. So instead he said, since the doctor Eryximachus was lying on the couch below him, Eryximachus, it's only fair that you either stop my hiccups or speak in my place until I can stop. And Eryximachus said, well, I'll do both. I'll speak in your turn, and when you stop, you can speak in mine. While I'm speaking, try holding your breath for a good while and see if the hiccups will stop on their own. If not, gargle with water. And if it's really stubborn, take something to tickle your nose and sneeze with it. If you do that once or twice, even a very stubborn case will stop. Go ahead and speak then, said Aristophanes, and I'll do as you say. So Eryximachus spoke. Since Pausanias, after making a fine start on his speech, didn't bring it to an adequate conclusion, I think it's necessary for me to try to put a finish on the argument. That love is twofold seems to me a fine distinction to have drawn. But that it isn't found only in the souls of human beings, directed toward the beautiful, but also occurs in many other things and in many other contexts, in the bodies of all living creatures, in things that grow in the earth, and one might say in everything that exists, this I think I've come to see through medicine, our own craft, namely how great and wonderful the God is, and how his reach extends over everything, both in human affairs and in divine ones. I'll begin my speech from medicine, so that we may pay due honor to our craft. The nature of bodies contains this twofold love, for the healthy and the diseased in the body are admittedly different and unlike, and the unlike desires and loves what is unlike. So the love directed at what is healthy is one thing, and the love directed at what is diseased is another. Now just as Pausanias was saying a moment ago that it's fine to grant favors to good men and shameful to grant them to unrestrained ones, so too within the bodies themselves it's fine and necessary to gratify what is good and healthy in each body, and this is exactly what is meant by the medical art. While it's shameful, and one must refuse to gratify what is bad and diseased, if one means to be skilled in the craft. For medicine, to put it briefly, is the science of the erotic affections of the body with respect to filling and emptying, and whoever can distinguish in these the fine love from the shameful one is the most skilled physician, and whoever can produce change so that one kind of love is acquired in place of the other, and in bodies that lack the love they should have, knows how to instill it, and to remove it where it's present but shouldn't be, would be a good practitioner. For he must be able to make the most hostile elements in the body into friends, and make them love one another. And the most hostile elements are the most opposite ones, cold to hot, bitter to sweet, dry to wet, and all such things. It was by knowing how to instill love and concord in these that our ancestor Asclepius, as these poets here say, and as I myself believe, established our craft. So medicine, as I say, is entirely governed by this God, and so are gymnastics and farming. As for music, anyone who pays even a little attention can see that it works the same way, which is perhaps what Heraclitus means to say too, though his words don't put it well. He says that the one, being at odds with itself, comes together with itself, like the harmony of a bow or a lyre. But it's quite absurd to say that a harmony is at odds with itself, or that it's still made up of things at odds with each other. What he probably meant was this, that out of the high note and the low note, which were at odds at first, harmony is produced once the art of music brings them into agreement afterward. Surely there could be no harmony while the high and low notes were still at odds with one another. Harmony is a kind of concord, and concord is a form of agreement, and agreement between things still at odds with each other is impossible so long as they remain at odds. And a thing that is discordant and out of agreement cannot be harmonized. It's the same with rhythm. It comes from fast and slow, which were at variance at first and are brought into agreement afterward. And in all these cases, it's music that installs the agreement, just as medicine does in its own sphere, by producing love and concord between the opposed elements. So music, too, is a kind of knowledge of the erotic matters that concern harmony and rhythm. In the actual arrangement of harmony and rhythm themselves, there's nothing hard about recognizing the erotic principles at work, and the double love hasn't yet appeared there. But when it comes to using rhythm and harmony on human beings, whether in composing, which people call songwriting, or in the correct use of already composed melodies and meters, which is called education, then it becomes difficult and calls for a skilled craftsman. And here we come back to the same point, that one must gratify and safeguard the love belonging to the orderly people and to those not yet orderly insofar as it will help them become so. And that is the beautiful love, the heavenly one, the love of the heavenly muse. But the love of Polyhymnia is the common one, which must be offered cautiously to whomever it's offered, so as to reap its pleasure without producing any excess. Just as in our own art, it's a great task to make good use of the appetites connected with the culinary art, so as to enjoy the pleasure of it without disease. So in music, in medicine, and in everything else, both human and divine, so far as it's possible, one must guard against both forms of love, since both are present in all these things. Even the arrangement of the seasons of the year is full of both of them. Whenever the elements I was just describing, the hot and the cold, the dry and the wet, meet each other under the orderly love, and take on a moderate harmony and blending, they arrive bringing good weather and health to human beings and to the other animals and plants, and do no harm. But whenever the love that goes with excess gets the upper hand in the seasons of the year, it destroys much and does much harm. For plagues tend to arise from such things, and many other irregular diseases afflict both animals and plants, and frosts, hailstorms, and blights come from the excess and disorder of these erotic elements in their relations with one another. And the knowledge of these things, as they concern the movements of the stars and the seasons of the year, is called astronomy. Furthermore, all the sacrifices and everything that the art of divination oversees, and this is the whole area of dealings between gods and human beings, concern nothing other than the guarding and healing of love. For all impiety tends to arise when someone fails to gratify the orderly love, or to honor and give him first place in everything he does, and instead honors the other one, whether in matters concerning parents, living or dead, or concerning the gods. It's the task assigned to divination to keep watch over lovers in these matters and to heal them, and divination is, in turn, the craftsman of friendship between gods and human beings, through its knowledge of the erotic affairs of human beings that bear on right and piety. So great and so vast, indeed practically total, is the power that love as a whole possesses, but the love that is directed toward good things and is brought to completion with moderation and justice, both among us and among the gods, has the greatest power of all, and provides us with our whole happiness, making us able to associate with one another and be friends, and even to be dear to the gods who are stronger than we are. Now I too, perhaps, in praising love, am leaving a great deal out, though not willingly. But if I've left anything out, it's your job, Aristophanes, to fill it in. Or if you have some other approach in mind for praising the god, go ahead and praise him, now that you've gotten over your hiccups. At this point, he said, Aristophanes took over and said that yes, they had indeed stopped, though not before the sneezing had been applied to them. So that I'm amazed, he said, that the orderly part of the body should crave such noises and ticklings as sneezing produces. In any case, it stopped right away, as soon as I applied the sneeze to it. And Eryximachus said, my good Aristophanes, watch what you're doing. You're making jokes just as you're about to speak, and you're forcing me to stand guard over your speech, in case you say something laughable, when you could be speaking in peace. And Aristophanes laughed and said, you're right, Eryximachus, consider everything I've said unsaid. But don't stand guard over me, since what I'm afraid of, in what I'm about to say isn't that I'll say something laughable, that would actually be a gain, and right at home with our muse, but that I'll say something absurd. You think you can throw the ball and dodge it, Aristophanes, he said, but pay attention, and speak as though you'll have to give an account of it. Perhaps, though, if I see fit, I'll let you off. Well, Eryximachus, said Aristophanes, I do intend to speak along rather different lines from the ones you and Pausanias took. It seems to me that people have entirely failed to perceive the power of love, for if they perceived it, they would have built him the grandest temples and altars, and would be offering him the greatest sacrifices. Not as things stand now, when none of this happens for him, though it's more than anything else that ought to happen. For he is the most human-loving of the gods, a helper of human beings, and a healer of those ills, whose cure would bring the greatest happiness to the human race. So I will try to explain his power to you, and you can go be teachers of it to everyone else. But first you need to learn about human nature and what has happened to it. Our nature long ago was not what it is now, but was of a different kind. In the first place, there were three sexes of human beings, not two as there are now, male and female, but a third besides, which combined both of these. Its name still survives, though the thing itself has vanished. There was once a being called Androgynous, one in both form and name, combining male and female, but now it exists only as a term of abuse. In the second place, the shape of each human being was completely round, with back and sides forming a circle. They had four hands and legs to match the hands, and two faces exactly alike on a rounded neck, one head for the two faces, which were set opposite each other, four ears, two sets of genitals, and everything else to match, as you might imagine from this. They walked upright, as we do now, in whichever direction they chose, and whenever they needed to run fast, they moved the way tumblers do, flinging their legs up and spinning around, except that they had eight limbs to push off with, so they went rolling along quickly in a circle. The reason there were three sexes, and of this kind, is that the male was originally an offspring of the sun, the female of the earth, and the one that combined both was an offspring of the moon, since the moon too shares in both sun and earth. They were round, and their motion was rolling, because they resembled their parents. They were tremendous in strength and power, and had great ambitions, and they made an attempt on the gods. What Homer says about Ephialtes and Attis is said of them, that they tried to climb up into heaven, meaning to attack the gods. So Zeus and the other gods took counsel about what they should do with them, and were at a loss. They couldn't bring themselves to kill them and wipe out the race with thunderbolts, as they had done with the giants, for that would mean losing the honors and sacrifices they received from human beings, and yet they couldn't let them go on behaving so outrageously. At last Zeus, thinking hard, said, "I believe I have a plan by which human beings can continue to exist, yet stop their unruly behavior by being made weaker. I will now," he said, "cut each of them in two. This will make them weaker, and at the same time more useful to us, because there will be more of them, and they will walk upright on two legs. And if they still seem to behave outrageously and won't keep quiet, I'll cut them in two again, so they'll have to hop along on one leg." Having said this, he cut human beings in two, the way people slice sorb apples before pickling them, or the way you'd cut an egg with a hair. And whenever he cut someone, he ordered Apollo to turn the face and the half of the neck around toward the cut, so that the person, seeing his own incision, would become more orderly and to heal the rest. So Apollo turned the face around, and pulling the skin together from all sides over what is now called the belly, like a purse drawn tight with a string, he tied off a single opening at the middle of the belly, which is what we now call the navel. He smoothed out most of the other wrinkles and shaped the chest with a tool something like the one shoemakers use to smooth wrinkles out of leather on a last. But he left a few wrinkles, the ones around the belly and the navel itself, as a reminder of the ancient experience. Now once our nature had been cut in two, each half, longing for its own other half, would come together with it, and throwing their arms around each other and tangling themselves together, desperate to grow into one, they began to die of hunger and general inactivity, because neither would do anything apart from the other. And whenever one of the halves died and the other was left, the one left behind would search for another and tangle itself together with that one, whether it happened to meet the half of a whole woman, what we now call a woman, or the half of a man, and so they kept perishing. But Zeus took pity on them and came up with another plan. He moved their genitals around to the front, for until then these two had been on the outside, and they had begotten and given birth not into one another, but into the ground, the way cicadas do. So he moved these organs around to the front, and by this means made it possible for them to breed with one another, through the male and the female, for the following reasons: so that in the embrace, if a man met with a woman, they might beget and the race continue, but also so that if male met with male, there might at least be satisfaction in their being together, after which they could rest, turn to their work, and attend to the rest of life. This, then, is the source from which the desire of human beings for one another has been implanted in us since so long ago, drawing our original nature back together, trying to make one out of two, and to heal human nature. Each of us, then, is a mere token of a human being, since each has been sliced in two like a flat fish, cut from one into two, and each of us is forever seeking the token that matches him. All those men who are cut from that combined sex, then called androgynous, are drawn to women, and most adulterers come from this kind, and likewise all the women drawn to men and given to adultery come from this kind. But those women who are cut from an original woman pay hardly any attention to men, being drawn instead to women, and the women who love other women come from this kind. But those who are a slice of the male pursue males. While they are boys, being little cuts of the male, they love men and delight in lying beside them and being wrapped in their arms, and these are the best of boys and young men, because they are by nature the most manly. Some people call them shameless, but that is a lie. They do this not out of shamelessness, but out of boldness and courage and manliness, welcoming what is like themselves. And here is strong proof. When they grow up, it is men of this sort, and only they, who turn out fit for public life. When they reach manhood, they are lovers of boys, and by nature take no interest in marriage or fathering children, though the law compels them to it. They would be content to live out their lives with one another, unmarried. Such a man, then, always becomes a lover of boys or a lover of his lover, always embracing what is kin to him. And whenever one of them, the boy lover or anyone else, happens upon his own actual half, then the pair are struck with amazement, with affection and belonging and desire, and they hardly want to be parted from each other for even a moment. These are the ones who stay together their whole lives through, and yet they could not even say what it is they want from one another. No one could suppose it is merely the partnership of sex, that this is why each takes such immense delight in the other's company. No, the soul of each is clearly longing for something else, something it cannot name. It can only divine what it wants and hint at it in riddles. And suppose, as they lay together, Hephaestus stood over them with his tools and asked, "What is it, you two, that you want from each other?" And when they could not answer, suppose he asked again, "Is this what you long for, to be joined together so completely that day and night you never leave each other's side? If that is your desire, I am willing to melt you down and weld you into one, so that from two you become one, and as long as you live a single life in common, as one being, and when you die a single death, one instead of two, together even in Hades. Look into yourselves, is this what you love? Would this satisfy you, if you could have it?" We know that on hearing this, not a single one would refuse, or show any sign of wanting anything else. Each would think he had heard, at last, the very thing he had longed for all along, to come together and be fused with his beloved, and from two to become one. And the reason is this: this was our original nature, and we were whole. So the name for the desire and pursuit of the whole is love. Before this, as I say, we were one, but now, because of our wrongdoing, the god has scattered us into separate dwellings, as the Arcadians were scattered by the Spartans. And there is reason to fear that if we do not behave decently toward the gods, we may be split yet again, and go about like the figures carved in profile on grave reliefs, sawn straight down the nose, turned into something like half-dice tokens. For these reasons, every man should urge every other to piety toward the gods, so that we may escape the one fate and win the other, with love as our leader and general. Let no one act against him, and whoever makes himself hateful to the gods does act against him. For if we become the gods' friends and are reconciled to him, we shall find and meet the beloveds who are truly our own, which few men nowadays manage to do. And let Eryximachus not interrupt me and turn my speech into comedy, as if I meant Pausanias and Agathon, though perhaps they really do belong to that class, both being male by nature. I am speaking about everyone, men and women alike. Our race would become happy if we brought love to fulfillment, and each of us found his own beloved and returned to his original nature. And if that is the best thing, then necessarily the best thing available in our present condition is what comes nearest to it, to find a beloved whose nature answers to one's own mind. And if we would hymn the God responsible for this, we would rightly hymn love, who in the present does us the greatest service by leading us toward what is our own, and for the future offers us the greatest hopes, that if we render piety to the gods, he will restore us to our original nature, heal us, and make us blessed and happy. There, Eryximachus, is my speech about love, a different sort from yours. So as I begged you, don't make a comedy of it. Let us hear what each of the rest will say, or rather each of the remaining two, since Agathon and Socrates are left. Well, I'll do as you say, Eryximachus said. In fact, I enjoyed your speech. And if I did not know that Socrates and Agathon were masters in matters of love, I would be very much afraid they might be at a loss for words, so much and so varied is what has already been said. As it is, I have every confidence. Then Socrates said, you fought your own round well, Eryximachus, but if you were where I am now, or rather where I will be when Agathon too has spoken well, you would be thoroughly frightened and at your wit's end, just as I am now. You want to put a spell on me, Socrates, said Agathon, so that I get flustered thinking the audience holds great expectations of my speaking well. I would have a poor memory indeed, Agathon, said Socrates, if, after seeing your courage and composure as you mounted the platform with your actors and faced that enormous audience, about to present your own words, without the slightest sign of panic, I now supposed you would be flustered on account of the few of us here. What, Socrates? Said Agathon. Surely you don't think me so stuffed with theater that I don't know a few men of sense are more frightening to anyone with a mind than a crowd of fools. No, Agathon, he said, it would be wrong of me to think anything boorish about you. I know quite well that if you met people you considered wise, you would care more for them than for the many. But I doubt we are those people. After all, we were there too, we were part of that crowd. Still, if you met other people who were wise, you would probably feel shame before them if you thought you were doing something shameful. Is that what you mean? That's true, he said. But before the many, you would feel no shame if you thought you were doing something shameful. At that point, Phaedrus broke in, he said. My dear Agathon, if you answer Socrates, it will no longer matter to him in the least how anything else here turns out, so long as he has someone to converse with, especially someone beautiful. Now I enjoy hearing Socrates converse, but it is my duty to look after the encomium to love and to collect a speech from each one of you. Pay the god his due, each of you, and then converse all you like. You're right, Phaedrus, said Agathon, and there's nothing to stop me speaking. There will be plenty of other chances to converse with Socrates. I want first to say how I ought to speak, and then to speak. All the previous speakers, it seems to me, have not been praising the god, but congratulating human beings on the good things the god causes for them. What sort of being he himself is, who gave these gifts, no one has said. Yet there is one right method for any praise of anything, to set out in words what sort of being the subject is, and what sort of things he causes. That is how we two ought rightly to praise love, first what he is, then what he gives. I say then that of all the gods, blessed as they all are, love, if one may say so without offense, is the most blessed, being the most beautiful and the best. He is most beautiful in this way. First, Phaedrus, he is the youngest of the gods. He supplies strong proof of this claim himself. He flees old age in headlong flight, and old age is fast, obviously, at any rate it comes at us faster than it should. Love by nature hates old age, and will not come within long range of it. With the young he always keeps company, and young he is. The old saying has it right, that like always draws near to like. And though I agree with Phaedrus on many other points, I do not agree with this one, that love is older than Cronos and Iapetos. I say he is the youngest of the gods and forever young, and that those ancient dealings among the gods, which Hesiod and Parmenides recount, happened under necessity, not love, if those poets were telling the truth. For there would have been no castrations or chainings of one another, nor all those other violences, if love had been among them, but friendship and peace, as there is now, ever since love has been king of the gods. So he is young, and besides being young, he is tender, though it would take a poet like Homer to display a god's tenderness. Homer says that Eight is a god and tender, her feet, at any rate, are tender, when he says, tender indeed are her feet, not on the ground does she set them, but upon the heads of men she walks. A fine piece of evidence, I think, for showing her tenderness, that she walks not on what is hard, but on what is soft. We shall use the same evidence about love, to show he is tender. He walks not upon the earth, nor upon skulls, which are none too soft, but in the softest things that exist he both walks and dwells. For he has set up house in the characters and souls of gods and men, and not, moreover, in all souls without exception. When he meets a soul with a hard character he departs, and where the character is soft, he settles in.